This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to the Friday morning sporting edition of Pacific Beat, coming to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I'm Richard Ewart, and in our lineup today, three Britons with a grand plan to put Nauru on the world soccer map, including former English Premier League star Dave Kitson.
We're going to be guests in another country. We're going to help as best we can. But ultimately, it's Nauru's Football Federation, and we just want to leave it in a place where they can really take it forward.
His Pacific Games medal was gold, but veteran tennis player William O'Connell fears for the future of his sport in Oceania.
It was a little bit sad for me to win a gold. It was definitely the weakest competition in the Pacific Games that I've been a part of. It looks like tennis is dying in the Pacific.
And World Paravolley's new vice president is on a mission to grow the sport across the Pacific and push for Paralympic recognition.
We want it to be inclusive, and we want more countries getting involved, and with the goal of getting it into Brisbane 32 and having a great participation of the Pacific nations.
Vanuatu Volleyball President Debbie Masivakalo, now Vice President of Paravolley's World Governing Body. We'll hear more about her ambitions for her sports later in the programme. But we start this morning with some very sad news coming out of Papua New Guinea, with Cricket PNG announcing the death of the Lewis captain Kaya Arua. The all-rounder, who was just 34, passed away in Port Moresby General Hospital. She first represented her country 14 years ago and went on to captain the side in nearly 40 T20 internationals, taking 59 wickets, a record for a PNG international player. Cricket PNG's chief executive Richard Dunn has released a statement saying our sincere condolences and love go to her family, including coach John Ovier and Lucy Ovier, who have both been long-serving staff here at Cricket PNG. Kaya had a remarkable playing career with the Lewis, he says, and at the right moment we will be recognising that contribution, but we wish to respect the family's privacy at this difficult time. It's a particularly sad end to what has been a landmark week for women's cricket in PNG, with the national side defeating Zimbabwe in a T20 international just a few days ago to record their first ever win over a full member of the International Cricket Council. Kaya was a guest on this programme several times in the past, and everyone here at Pacific Beat would like to send their condolences to Kaya's family and friends, her teammates and coaches. Now, it's the biggest weekend of the Rugby Sevens calendar, with the World Series rolling into the home of Sevens, Hong Kong. It's a venue where Fiji have had great success over the years, but a win this time will be more welcome than most, with the side having failed to win a single tournament for nearly 2 years now. They go into Hong Kong with a new coach at the helm, Osir Kolasinac, the man who captained the team to Olympic gold in 2016. He was a hugely popular choice to take over when the interim board finally ran out of patience with the Englishman Ben Gollings. But does Kolasinac have the coaching experience to turn things around? Well, since retiring as a player, he has had notable success coaching the women's national team in China, but perhaps the hard work there had already been done for him. Former Fiji Sevens development coach and the Fiji Rugby Union's first video analyst, Oscar Umuumalovo, was academy coach in China for 4 years. He says he would have applied for the job as men's sevens coach if it had been advertised. And he says it was he who put in all the groundwork with China's youth Olympic team, which contained most of the players Kolasinac then led to championship success. You took and coached those girls at a young age. Osir Kolasinac, yes, took them on and was very successful. What do you make of his achievements in China as a first-time coach?
I think I did the fundamentals and the basics for 4 years with those girls. And then when I left, about 13 of those girls were drafted into the national team that Kolasinac took. Basically, the job was much, much easier because of them learning the basics at an early age, 14, 15, 16 to 18.
Are you saying, therefore, that we shouldn't read too much into what he achieved with that team when they reached the adult level? Because they went on to become Asian champions, I think.
Yes, because you cannot build champions in few weeks. Champions are made for a very long time. And when I inquire about the team, my contact from China told me that 11 to 13 players were from the group that I took.
So that said, a lot of people have pointed to, say, Colin Nassau's success in China as a good reason why he should be given a go looking after the Fiji men's sevens team. But it would seem to me to be perhaps a much bigger jump than it already appeared to be. I mean, he's taking on an enormous task with not that much experience of coaching.
My line of thinking is on that line too, because I'm really upset with how Fiji Rugby Union handles the coaching positions for national teams, because they never advertise that position, because that stipulates in the employment policy of Rugby Union that any job has to be advertised. If it was advertised, to be frank with you, I will be the first one to apply for the post, because I know the drawbacks of the coaches now is the inability to read games through video analysis. Because when I was with Fiji Rugby, I was the first one trained for this. And it builds up your capacity to become a better coach if you know how to analyze players, how to analyze team performance and all those things. Because yes, it's a big jump. It has proven that not all good players are good coaches.
So what is your view on how Ben Gollings fared as coach of the Fiji Sevens team? He won the World Cup, which neither of his predecessors managed to do, Gareth Baber and Ben Ryan. But on the other hand, his success in the World Series was not great. 19 or 20 tournaments without a win. Fiji still third on the ladder, but of course, that's not good enough. Fijian supporters and the FRU demand a lot more.
I think Ben was really not supported well by people who should be supporting him, because I think FRU just handpicked people who they think can be able to do the job, especially ex-players. I'm saying this because I know these players. They come up with players that they like, players that they are from their province. I think Ben was not able to do a good job because of his advisors around him.
Do you think, therefore, that the nucleus of the side that Ben Gollings has built and that Osea Colin Nassau has now inherited is good enough to go to the Olympics and win a third gold medal for Fiji?
Yes, basically, because our selection criteria has really changed. We normally run provincial sevens, but now we are selecting from club sevens. So I know it will be very difficult to actually get results, but putting them together in the right environment for a longer period of time, which is what Ben was doing, we'll be able to get the Olympic gold medal for the third time.
Therefore, do you think the decision to remove Ben Gollings was a panic decision and to some degree perhaps brought about by public pressure on social media from fans and ex-players?
I think 70% of the call was from the public, because when Fiji Rugby Union was expelled because of non-compliance and then the Board of Trustees came in, I feel that there were no rugby-minded people in that board to be able to stand with Ben, because we cannot build champions in days or weeks. We need to have a system in place that is running for a period of time and then reaping the results.
So the fact that he went 19 or 20, I think it was in the end, World Series tournaments without taking out any one of them, you feel that there was still progress here, that the team he had was moving forward?
It was moving forward because those people were just raw talents. All they need was fix their core skills, the functional roles of sevens, and then putting them together, playing them together in environment. Because I think most of the times these people are tested in the provincial sevens that is going around. But unfortunately, we are not having those provincial sevens. All of a sudden, they are tested in a World Rugby Seven Series. So you will see that the result will not always be there.
So picking up on the point you made earlier about what Osea Colin Nassau did coaching in China, it's all set up for a repeat performance, isn't it? He's going to inherit a side which was in a development stage. In your view, moving forward, maybe he will be the person to just make them click.
Yeah, maybe, because I think that reputation in the first Olympic gold medal Fiji. I think that reputation will carry him through with the work that Ben has already done with the selection and the training of the players that are with OSEA now.
Oscar Umuahumalova, who would have loved to have thrown his hat into the ring for the Fiji Men's Sevens coaching job, but the FIU chose not to advertise the post. And for the record, Fiji's first pool round game in Hong Kong will be against Australia tonight, followed by Canada and then France tomorrow. Meanwhile, Fiji's women's team will also start against Australia, followed by South Africa and finally Ireland, that game tomorrow also. And in Super Rugby, the Fijian Ndrua are in Melbourne to play the Rebels tonight, while tomorrow Fijiana Ndrua will take on the Brumbies in Canberra. You're with Pacific Beat, the Friday morning sporting edition. I'm Richard Hewitt, and in contrast to the FIU we were hearing about earlier, Lakapi Samoa certainly did advertise when they decided they wanted a new coach to lead their Mano 15. Unfortunately, they don't appear to have told the incumbent Selala Mapasua, whose contract still had 8 months to run. The decision to dispense so abruptly with Mapasua's services has stirred up a hornet's nest, with former All Black Lima Sopawanga, who played for Samoa at the World Cup last year, warning that he and other heritage players might reconsider their positions now. Meanwhile, the Manu Sevens team is teetering on the brink of a relegation battle in the World Series. So, the chief executive of Lakapi Samoa, Vincent Fapuliai, has a lot on his plate right now, but he's defending the union's decision to draft in former captain Mohonri Schwalga to take charge of the men's 15.
Mohonri's worked his way back into the union and has been working with our development teams and taking some of our development teams to competitions overseas. And then most recently, last couple of years, been the assistant coach at Zaylala.
So the question, therefore, would be that clearly he appears to have worked his passage, as it were, to the point where he became assistant to the national men's team. But why has Selala's contract been ended so soon when in general consensus was he didn't do a bad job at the World Cup, bearing in mind all the difficulties the Manu faced?
Well, the union seems to differ on the result of what's been happening. I think there was a review that was done, and I guess that's where the board decided that it was the right time to make changes and I think to move forward for the next World Cup, and I think give Mohonri every opportunity to start developing a team for the next World Cup.
My understanding, though, is that the first that Selala knew that his job was under threat was when he saw the advertisement. Nobody had told him. That's a little disrespectful, isn't it?
There was a review that he was part of. That report was submitted to the board in January, and then the board decided from the result of that review to re-advertise the position.
But that advertisement, according to him, was placed without his knowledge. I mean, surely he should have been told.
I think I did advise them that the position would be re-advertised, yeah, and the decision of the board, and that I did advise them before I left on leave.
Historically, when Tuilaepa was chairman of the Samoan Rugby Union, Lakapi Samoa as it now is, it was said on more than one occasion that a lot of the decisions had been made by him rather than by the board or by the broader union. He's still there, of course, as chairman of Lakapi Samoa. Has he had an undue influence on this decision? I mean, you've been out of the picture yourself because of ill health for a little while. Has Tuilaepa basically made this decision himself?
When the board convened, it was a unanimous decision. It wasn't a decision made by any individual or the chair.
Even though historically he and Mohonri don't get on. Mohonri wanted him removed as chairman, I think, back in 2011. Admittedly, that was 13 years ago. And as you say, he's worked his way back into the union. So maybe they're friends again, but maybe not.
Well, I don't want to speculate anything. All I can tell you is that Mohonri is now, come on board in the union in the last couple of years, has worked with us. So as far as I'm concerned, we haven't looked back on the issues that have gone past before our time. So Mohonri has been a valuable member of the union and he has worked his way back. But in talking about 2011, that's 13 years ago, I don't want to reflect on what happened in the past.
Talking about the situation with the Sevens team, they are in dire straits at the moment. There's every chance they're going to be involved in the new system of promotion and relegation playoffs in Madrid later in the year. I'm wondering if the board feels that Salah's performance as coach of the Manasamar 15s was not up to the standard they were looking for. How come Brian Lemar has survived as coach of the Sevens team when they, as I say, are in dire straits?
Every team and every campaign has a review after completion of the competition. So it's too early to tell yet whether he will follow down the same road, but he still has a contract at the moment and the competition is still going at the moment. So yes, we do acknowledge that things are not working out with the Sevens at the moment.
Looking at the current standings, it seems to me unless Samoa go out at Hong Kong over the weekend and win, they're almost certainly going to end up in these promotion relegation playoffs in Madrid, which will be uncharted waters, not just for them, of course, but for all the teams involved.
Well, that's the way things are at the moment with the Sevens program. We've given every support to try and do well in the HSBC series, but also aiming to do well at the Olympics in Paris. Unfortunately, there's a lot of other factors that come into play. There's quite a lot of injuries in our squad, so we made quite a lot of changes.
When the board last met, did the subject of the Sevens players paying conditions come up? Because, of course, that's received a lot of publicity on social media and elsewhere. And my understanding is that the board were going to look at it. So did they do that? And if so, what conclusion did they reach?
That decision and of the board regarding the Sevens players' payments was done right back in early January, and the matter was settled between the union and the players.
So does that mean they're getting paid more now?
No, I think there was a lot of misunderstanding and clarity. And then I think the union has always stood by what it can afford to pay the players. And I think once the board sat down with the team and management and the players and understood that what they're currently getting is very reasonable compared to what has been done in the past, but also look at the situation of the union on a year-to-year basis of what it can afford to pay them.
So more broadly, how would you assess the state of Lakapi Samoa's finances right now? Because my understanding is that perhaps money that should have been or would have been coming through from government isn't, and that might be down to political rivalry.
Well, it's difficult at the moment. We've just come out of the pandemic over the difficult period that we've gone through, and then the Rugby World Cup. We're still not out of the woods yet. We've engaged a new commercial partners who are now engaging to try and lock in sponsorship for the next couple of years up to Rugby World Cup. And it's very difficult in this current environment to try and secure sponsorship because the Manasamo 15, Manasamo 7s and possibly Manasina, they are the only income earners for the union, you know, with the front of jersey and back of jerseys on exposure. So it's quite a difficult ask for us.
It has been suggested to me that one of the reasons perhaps that the union is experiencing greater financial difficulties than it might otherwise is because of that question of government money and because the ex-prime minister is still your chairman, and of course his major rival is now prime minister, and what I'm being told is therefore money has been cut off.
That's not a fact. We're still getting funding from government. Even when the current chairman was prime minister, this doesn't mean that he was giving us all the money from government. It doesn't operate that way. You know, we're still getting funding from government as normal every year, and we still approach government to support us in other ways when we do host events here.
Lakapi Samoa CEO Vincent Fapulia on the line from Apia, and those events he mentioned will include test matches against Spain and Italy in Apia in July, to be followed by a Pacific Nations Cup encounter with Tonga, who, like the Flying Fijians, are still yet to appoint their new men's 15s coach. Meanwhile, the Manu Sevens will start that vital Hong Kong campaign this afternoon against Spain, followed by Ireland and then South Africa tomorrow. And in Super Rugby Pacific, Moana Pacifica go in search of their third win of the season against the fourth-place Chiefs. That's in Hamilton tomorrow. Time to take a look at some of the news headlines from around the Pacific on this Friday morning. Keeping an eye for us here at Pacific Beach, it's Evan Wasuka. Evan, good morning.
Good morning, Richard.
So fresh calls for Indonesia to be stripped of its membership of the Melanesian Spearhead Group and for West Papuan activists to be given full membership in their place, I guess.
Yeah, that's right, Richard. So this call was made during an event in Vanuatu earlier this week, which was attended by the president of the United Liberation Movement for West Papua, Benny Wenda. Now, ULMWP are calling for Indonesia to be stripped of its associate membership because of the ongoing violence and alleged human rights abuses. The latest case being that video that's been circulated on social media of Indonesian military personnel torturing a West Papua civilian in a barrel. So a statement from the ULMWP say full membership would give West Papua the ability to defend their identity as Melanesian people and expose abuses of human rights taking place in their territory. They also highlighted cases of Indonesia lobbying in Vanuatu and the Pacific. The statement from ULMWP say that this is a campaign to undermine ULMWP's campaign in the region. And they're calling on Vanuatu to maintain its commitment to West Papua, to the West Papua movement. This is the first event Benny Wenda has staged in the region since we had a situation last year where the MSG decided not to give membership to ULMWP, and he ended up losing his presidency. But then towards the end of last year, he regained it again. So interesting to see what the developments come out from that story.
Absolutely. And also in Vanuatu, an increase in pay for opposition MPs, but not even on the opposition side, not everyone supports this. So what's happening here?
Yeah, so this is a strange one. A pay rise, usually you see this on the government side of things. But this one is on the opposition side. This is the Daily Post newspaper is reporting that pay rise all around for the deputy leader of opposition, opposition whip and chair and the chairs and vice chairs of parliamentary standing committees. And the pay rises came into effect on March the 27th. The government is saying that the payment will bring these officials in line with similar responsibilities held by government MPs. It'll bring up the pay to around 5 million vatu or 44,000 US. So it's supposed to be leveling out the pay between the government and the opposition office holders. But the opposition leader, Ismail Kalsikau, isn't happy with the changes, and he wants the upcoming referendum to be delayed so that the public can have their say on things like this, the pay rise as well. So, another interesting situation there.
And finally to Fiji, where the saga rolls on following that 60 Minutes TV show of a couple of weeks ago, allegations levelled at one Chinese person in particular in Fiji. Now the ambassador has come out and refuted allegations, essentially those allegations, and also those levelled against the embassy.
Yeah, so those, the 60 Minute program and the investigative story around it accused a hotel owner in Fiji of being a political operator for the Chinese government. And this person was also accused of being a member of a criminal syndicate. Fiji Broadcasting Corporation is reporting that China's ambassador in Fiji, Zhou Jian, is calling the story baseless and bullying and coercion tactics. The ambassador is saying that the embassy is committed to local laws and regulations. He says any criminal activity should be reported to authorities rather than being using microphone diplomacy or coercion. He described that 60-minute program and the report by the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project as speculative media campaigns. So we'll see how that also unfolds.
Yes, I have a feeling the whole thing's going to go down a rather large rabbit hole, really, but it continues to roll on. Evan, thank you very much indeed for the update. Evan Wasuka there with our Pacific Beat News Wrap.
Thank you.
In the Fale is a music show on ABC Radio Australia, hosted by me, Paola Tukefu. I'll be spinning my favourite tunes from dancehall to disco, calypso to country, reggae to roots, and hip-hop to house music, from across the eras to keep the kids and the aunties happy. If it has a pumping groove, I'll be bringing it to you to bump you into the weekend.
In the Fale, Friday afternoon at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
It was Pacific Beat, the Friday morning sporting edition. I'm Richard Hewitt, and first it was Marshall Islands, and now Nauru has been grabbing international headlines with the news that another of the smallest countries in the world is planning to field a national soccer team for the first time. The Marshalls claim to be the only country on the planet that has never had a team, but while sides representing Nauru have featured in, shall we say, ad hoc matches in the past, they have never played as one nation against another. Now, a trio of Britons have joined forces with the aim of putting soccer in Nauru on the international map and by the end of this year. And they include a former English Premier League player who made his name with Reading, a team based an hour away from London.
Played into Kitson here, great chance, and a goal! Dave Kitson marks his 100th league appearance for Reading with a goal, his 50th for the club. He's been a wonderful servant for Reading.
As well as Reading, Dave Kitson played for six other English league clubs, making more than 400 appearances and scoring nearly 130 goals. But it was a mutual interest in off-the-grid tourism that's led him to join forces with the owner of Young Pioneer Travel, Gareth Johnson, and put together a plan to get a Nauru soccer team on the field with the approval of Federation President Kaz Kane.
So I met Kaz in 2020, just before the pandemic, and we tried to get something going then. It didn't happen. And then I went back to Nauru, December just gone, got talking with Kaz, we made an agreement, and he actually gave me the autonomy to get everything going. And then the big plan is to raise money, send a coach out in July, play a game in August.
Gareth called me about a year ago and said, look, I think I'm going to try to do something here, and I think I want to try and start a football team. And then it sort of ramped up at the back end of last year, and then really went into overdrive where I said, yeah, I've done it, I'm part of the FA, and happy to have us there and try to help, and do you want to be a part of it? And I said, yeah, no, absolutely, definitely, I said I would, and it sounds great.
The third man involved in the ambitious project is Charlie Pomroy, owner and coach of the Cambodian team Angkor City. He's planning to be on the ground in Nauru for a year as the new team comes together, while Dave Kitson, as manager, will make his first visit to the island in June.
Anything I can do to raise PR and awareness and help and funding, any of that kind of stuff, that's a skill set that I can bring to the table. So Gareth said, well, look, you know, why don't you help to manage the first game and then you can slip into this ambassadorial role. I think in terms of the actual coaching of the team, Charlie will head that up and I'll help him. I'll try and put in place a philosophy of how we can play, how best to go about the matches and the training, based on what we have to work with.
The big question is, where will the players come from? Gareth Johnson, who's now the Nauru Federation's Director of Development, says he has eyes on those who are currently playing other sports on the island, but he certainly intends to scour the diaspora for talent as well.
So that's definitely something we're going to do. But actually, I've got a lot of hope of finding players on the island. Basically, there's a bunch of guys that are playing Aussie rules. I've spoken to a lot of them. I've spoken to some of the women who play rugby on the island. And I'm hoping I'm going to get a lot of them to code switch and give soccer a go.
As far as recruiting from the diaspora is concerned, Dave Kitson is not opposed to the idea, but he's wary of costs. And in the end, he's happy to work with the best players they can find on Nauru itself.
I see a lot of projects and I think, whatever happened to coaching? That's the whole point of coaching, you know, to try and improve people, to try and help. So going out and just trying to get the absolute best team you can for the sake of it doesn't totally square with my philosophy on football. I've got no qualms about coaching whatever we find on the island. And they're under no illusions either about, you know, the talent pool on the island because it's such a small population.
Kitson says the AFL culture on Nauru can be an asset for the soccer team, and he's hopeful of uncovering one or two gems.
Looking at that, you start to form this theory about, well, you know, whatever else we'll be tough, we'll be strong, we'll be hard to beat, and you go from there. But you're right, you know, there could be a couple of rough diamonds out there. And that goes back to my point of whatever happened to coaching. It's like Arsene Wenger said, show me the athlete and I'll show you the footballer. As long as you've got the enthusiasm and the will and the desire to get better, that's nine-tenths of it right there.
A key part of the Nauru plan is to galvanise soccer right across Micronesia and develop a strategy which will see teams from those countries play one another on a regular basis.
We're currently in talks with Palau, Marshall Islands, Micronesia, and Tuvalu and Kiribati with regards to setting up a Micronesian football union. And that's kind of in advanced stages. So it'll be all the non-FIFA countries under one umbrella. Now, the long-term plan with that is to play a futsal tournament next summer.
Once the union is signed off, then the aim would be to band together and lean on the Oceania Football Confederation to give long-time associates Kiribati and Tuvalu full membership and a pathway to FIFA.
Kiribati Island Football Federation and Tuvalu as well. They are bending over backwards to fit all the criteria for the OFC. Both Tuvalu and Kiribati are good at football. They have domestic leagues. And one might argue they're a little bit more qualified than Cook Islands or American Samoa, for example. One might argue that. So one of the primary reasons for us to set up this football union is to put pressure on the OFC to help get them in. And also we can, as a group, help each other hit the criteria.
Dave Kitson says an important part of the process on Nauru is to ensure that the team that emerges is their team. The Soccer Federation has a new custom-designed logo now, for example, but only after the Islanders had their say.
That logo went back and forward hundreds of times to the people of Nauru until they were absolutely happy with it. You know, you've got to have the stars, you've got to have this, you've got to have that, you can't have this. And all we did was provide the graphic designer to make it exactly how they wanted it. So that was an example of that partnership working. We're going to be guests in another country. We're going to help as best we can. But ultimately, it's Nauru's Football Federation, and we just want to leave it in a place where they can really take it forward.
One thing is for sure, Nauru's first 11-a-side international won't be played on home soil, because right now, they just don't have the facilities.
We would have to go to another country. Kiribati, they've offered to play us. One thing in our favour is Nauru Airline. We're talking to them about them helping us and sponsoring us. We've actually got a number of local companies that we're talking to that are interested in sponsoring us as well. So we are really trying to make this a community thing. Long term, we want to get OFC associate membership. We want to get FIFA membership. And, you know, that's obviously not going to happen tomorrow. But if we can get FIFA membership and the grants that come in with that, then we can build fields, we can do all these things.
Above all, Dave Kitson and Gareth Johnson want to create a pathway for soccer to develop on Nauru in the future.
We're trying to create a legacy. We're trying to create something that does grow and become something. I'm not romantic enough to think that whoever we play in our first match, that we're going to win. I'm realistic in what our objectives are, and that is play at least one match, to be competitive, to highlight that you can play football on the island and start growing things so that we can get good results in the future.
Whatever happens, win, lose or draw, and no one's naive enough to think that Nauru will start qualifying for major competitions. It's not what it's about. But it's about trying to put something on the pitch where the kids can look at it and go, yeah, I want to be a part of that. That looks good. That looks fun. I want to get involved. I want to start kicking a ball about. And that will be the legacy. But it can't be this white savior project, all of us Europeans coming in and start running the show. It has to be a collaborative effort, and it has to be led by the people of Nauru.
Kitson, Tunchai.
Dave Kitson is excited at the prospect of passing on his knowledge to a Nauru team, and back home his story is being followed closely by the UK media. Gareth Johnson wants to see a team take to the field in Nauru colours before the year is out, and he says he won't accept anything less.
I'd be more than disappointed. I would consider it a failure. We're not saying we'd be a packed stadium against a really big nation or anything, but I do feel we've got the potential, and things have moved quickly enough, that we could definitely get something done this year.
Yeah, you kind of believe that they can, don't you? That's Gareth Johnson, the Nauru Soccer Federation's Director of Development. So the suggestion is that that very first match could be against Marshall Islands, which would be their very first match too. American Samoa have also put their hats into the ring as possible opponents for Nauru. It's a fascinating story of the little countries in the Pacific looking to muscle their way onto the world soccer scene. We'll keep you posted with further developments.
Disasters are inevitable, but losing your life or home isn't. Learn what to do before, during, and after disaster in a program aimed at helping you keep safe. Pacific Prepared is all things disaster preparedness for the Pacific, with a team of reporters on the ground, having conversations, and bringing you the stories that could help you, your family, and community prepare for natural disasters. Pacific Prepared, Fridays from 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, a Pacific Games gold medal would normally be cause for celebration, but after taking out the men's doubles title with his partner Charles Cornish at the tennis in Honiara 3 months ago, Fiji's William O'Connell says his result points to a sport that could be on its last legs in the Pacific. The former captain of the Oceania Billie Jean King Cup team has also weighed in on the state of women's tennis in the region, claiming that equality is in short supply. However, the newly appointed technical director for the Vanuatu Tennis Federation paints a more positive picture, although, as Lauren Beldy reports, she concedes that to make it as a female tennis player in the Pacific is tough.
When Lorraine Bonamatuku was offered one of the top jobs with Vanuatu Tennis, she almost turned it down. But realising, in her words, that Vanuatu is a male-dominated society, she recognised it was an honour and a privilege to be offered such a role. She was further inspired by her attendance at a Pacific Women's Leaders workshop organised by Tennis Australia. But she says in terms of developing the women's game in Oceania, her first and biggest problem is numbers.
We do not have enough girls and women in our tennis program, so we were supposed to send a team to West Pacific. We do not have girls to participate and represent Vanuatu in that category. So I was thinking one of the things that we should do in our program is to go into schools, run school programs, and then let the kids come down and try out tennis at the tennis courts, but also to go out into communities and let them know more about the sport and what it can do to benefit the kids.
As a teenager, Lorraine got the chance to develop her skills at the Regional Academy in Fiji and then later in the US. But such scholarships, once organised by former Oceania Tennis Secretary General Dan O'Connell, are no longer available as the academy over which he presided is closed.
When I was 15, I got offered a tennis scholarship by Dan O'Connell to go and attend the ITF Academy in Fiji. This academy is where the best from all the Pacific go to. So I was selected from my country to go there and train and also study. I studied and played tennis there for 4 years until I was 18 years old. Then I got offered a scholarship from Dan O'Connell to study in the States.
Like his father, William O'Connell has played a leading role in Pacific tennis for a number of years as both player and coach. And he says the loss of a scholarship system was a serious blow to his sport.
The college pathway thing was so good for players from our area. It motivated players to pursue their tennis to a high level as a junior, but then also allowed them to progress beyond the junior stage. And then I think there needs to be a little bit of reform selecting our adult teams. If you're constantly cherry-picking players that have never set foot in the island, it disgruntles the players that are homegrown, and so they become resentful and they don't play anymore.
O'Connell bemoans what he describes as micromanaging and poor governance. During his time as captain of Oceania's Billie Jean King Cup team, he says he was excluded from the selection process.
They have clear procedure where I'm meant to be included in the selection process, and they kept me out of it. And this is an issue that's happened in the past. I remember in 2017 when I was vying for selection on our Davis Cup team as a player, they excluded the captain, who definitely was more knowledgeable about the players and recent results. And I think it would have been hard to deny me a spot had the captain been present in that selection meeting.
But the thing that rankled him most was money. He, like his father, insists that female players representing Oceania were not being paid.
In both my years as captain, I requested access to a budget so I could plan our preparation and our time in Malaysia so that there would be money left over at the end without being too stingy over the course of the tour to pay the girls, because I'd known that the guys had been paid for the 2 years prior. And I thought it's better I left and maybe came back at a later date when there was good governance and some fairness for the women.
A month after William O'Connell resigned, some money was made available for the players at last. Despite being appointed to a high-ranking role in Vanuatu, Lorraine Bonamatuku says she has no knowledge of the pay issues raised by both William and Dan O'Connell. Her boss and president of the Oceania Tennis Federation, Cyril Mongi, has previously told Pacific Beat that female players are well catered for. And in Vanuatu, at least, the new technical director says she's satisfied when it comes to the question of gender equality.
My views here in Vanuatu Tennis Federation, I think we're very equal. We have members in the board who are women, and also our federation encourages females. We have officials who are women. We need more women coaches. I'm not too sure about other federations, but from my point of view, in our federations, we're very inclusive.
William O'Connell's view remains that gender equality is in short supply across Oceania. And he says players that he has worked with will be well aware of that.
I did my best to keep it separate, but I mean, some of the older players and some of the other players that have grown up around me, they know that there's problems. And for the good of Pacific Tennis, I've tried to keep it civil. And so they, I think, suspected that there were problems under the surface.
So what does the future hold for tennis in the Pacific? In Vanuatu, at least, Lorraine Bunimatuku says there are plans to increase female involvement, but she admits it's tougher for girls to succeed on the courts.
Yes, it's harder, but we're finding new ways. Here in Vanuatu, our federation is focusing on that and trying to create pathways for our girls. So we have some players who recently did the CBI Level 1 course, and it's a course to become qualified coaches. And then we also have officials. So right now, our federation is looking into ways to keep our girls in tennis.
As the new kid on the block, Lorraine Bunimatuku is upbeat about what she can do in her country, at least, not only to strengthen the female game in particular, but also to encourage wider female involvement in her sport.
I feel excited. I'm looking forward to go out into communities with other coaches, to do awarenesses and also talk about the sport of tennis and its benefits and what it can do to their kids. Also encourage other women to come and just be involved. For example, we have a parent here. She just brought her son down to play tennis. He joined the development program. And through the years, she got really involved that she's now our treasurer for Vanuatu Tennis Federation.
Bunimatuku says she's grateful to Tennis Australia, Pacific Oz Sports and the Oceania Federation for the mentoring and learning opportunities that got her this far. She says Vanuatu has a development program and a schools program up and running. All reasons to be optimistic. But William O'Connell says, based on his recent experience at the Pacific Games, he wants to see the ITF Academy in Fiji reopened urgently as a means to raise standards right across the region. And new talent, female and male, can't come soon enough, because after his experience at the Pacific Games last year, he believes tennis in Oceania is on the edge.
I've been a part of the Pacific Games since 2011, and the competition has been pretty solid up until this last Games. And now some of it, to be fair, is because some of the players could not get over to the Pacific. The universities weren't willing to release them. But for me, going to the last Pacific Games in the Solomon Islands, it was a little bit sad for me to win a gold. It was definitely the weakest competition in a Pacific Games that I've been a part of. It looks like tennis is dying in the Pacific.
William O'Connell voicing his fears about the future of tennis in Oceania after winning what he clearly regards as a rather tarnished gold medal at the Pacific Games in Solomon Islands last December. And the reporter there was Lauren Baldy. Pacific Beat. Now, the sport of para-volleyball has a new flag bearer in the Pacific after the president of the Vanuatu Volleyball Federation, Debbie Masavakala, was appointed as vice president of World Para-Volley. And now her aim is to see the sport grow and develop right across the Pacific, using the Vanuatu experience as the example for others to follow. Right now, Vanuatu is the only Pacific nation with an established para-volley program, with variations played indoors and on the beach. With 8 years to go before the Paralympics on the Pacific's doorstep in Brisbane, the new vice president is optimistic that all three para-volley disciplines will be represented at the Games and that several Pacific teams will compete.
Currently, para-sitting volleyball is in the para-games, but our aim is that by Brisbane 32, we would like para-beach. Volleyball, it's a popular sport in the Pacific. It's high participation. So we want it to be inclusive and We want more countries getting involved and with the goal of getting it into Brisbane 32 and having a great participation of the Pacific nations.
What do you think it's going to take to get that level of development? I mean, clearly volleyball has a good presence in the Pacific, beach volleyball in particular, but for some reason paravolley doesn't seem to have caught on yet. I mean, are there particular reasons why it's difficult for countries to get into that sport?
Well, we're lucky that there is a few representatives of World Para Volleyball and Oceania Asia Para Volleyball in Australia. So we have their development officer and their referee officer both based in Australia. So they've came to Vanuatu twice. So I think it's just getting the message out and also how people can get involved. So we started because we had a cyclone in Santo and there was about 80 people with disability displaced in a shed. And then my staff said, like, you know, what are we going to do? And I said, well, mental health is important, especially when they've just lost everything. I said, get a string and a ball and get them playing some para volleyball. So off they went and they got a string and a ball. And at the first day, there was only, you know, maybe five or six because they were quite shy. But by the end of the week, there was like 60 people playing. And then that's how we started para volleyball. And then I thought, well, we need a bit of knowledge in this sport. So then I contacted World Para Volleyball and they put me on to the offices in Australia. And then the relationship grew. So, yeah, we didn't know how to get involved. We just investigated. But now we've opened up the door and we've made connections. And I was just at the Oceania Volleyball AGM in Hawaii where all the other presidents from the Pacific were there and I spoke to them and Solomons, Papua New Guinea, Tuvalu, they're all very keen to get para volleyball into their countries now. So yeah, it's been great and I think it's going to be even better.
Presumably, as is always the case, funding will be an issue. Do these countries that you've mentioned have money available to get off the ground with the sport or will they need to find money from somewhere?
Well, we've been really lucky because World Para Volleyball is a very supportive organisation. So through our last two courses, it was funded by World Para Volleyball and supported by them. So there is support from World Para Volleyball and also your National Paralympic Committee. You can apply for some support. So there is support organisations out there that can help you to start by just having a coaching course or an awareness course. So we can always, you know, help each other.
And for those athletes that get involved, I think you've already indicated it has a huge impact on them personally, on their state of well-being, how they feel about themselves.
Yeah, so we run every week at the Vanuatu Society of People with Disability, and given the high level of cases of non-communicable diseases and diabetes in Vanuatu, which is probably similar in other Pacific nations, there's quite a number of amputees every week. And some of these people that are now participating in our Wednesday program, they used to be abled volleyball players. You know, they were in clubs and leagues. And due to having diabetes, they've now had to have their leg taken off. But now they're coming back and playing volleyball and they couldn't be happier. You see them every Wednesday and just the ray of light on their faces. That's what you do it for because they're just so happy now that they can do what they love again.
Which is fantastic. And that's a huge incentive for you and everybody else, isn't it, to push ahead and develop the sport around the Pacific. Just for those who may not be familiar with para volley, what are the different types that people can play? Am I right that it's three different types?
There is the sitting para volleyball, which is in the Paralympic Games, which is very similar to indoor volleyball, same rules. That's another benefit. If you're an indoor referee, you can easily become a para sitting volleyball referee. And then there is standing beach volleyball. So that is three aside. We have a good relationship with the Australian standing beach team. And their captain came over last year and gave a workshop to our team. And then there's also sitting beach volleyball as well, which is a new sport. But we're aiming and we want to push to get more teams and people playing so we can get standing beach into the Paralympic Games in Brisbane 32.
The president of the Vanuatu Volleyball Federation and now the vice president of World Para Volley, Debbie Masavakalo, on the line from Port Vila. Just to mention, the PNG Hunters are in action against the Tweedhead Seagulls in the Host Plus Super Cup this weekend. They're looking good this year. See if they can record another win. That's it from me, Richard Ewart. The afternoon edition of Pacific Beat will be along at 5 past 5 PNG time this afternoon. And we're back on Monday morning, 5 past 6. In the meantime, have a great sporting weekend.